Welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, a weekly podcast from Hobeck Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, mystery, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of running a creative business in this challenging world. We'll hear from the people who make this possible, the authors, the cover designers and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on the Hobcast Book Show from Hobeck Books, as we combine trad values and an indie spirit. And welcome to the Hobcast. It is episode 119. My name is Adrian Hobart.
And my name is Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hobeck Books, UK independent publishers of the following four genres.
Suspense.
Crime.
Mystery.
And thrillers. Welcome to the show. And we are delighted with our guest this week.
We are delighted with our guest this week. Our guest this week is Jude Hayland.
Yes, who joined us from her home in Winchester. Jude is a novelist. She has an epic background in writing short fiction for the magazine trade, particularly in the UK. And she's also a creative writing teacher. So there's loads and loads of things to get from
her. She knows a lot about writing, doesn't she?
Yeah, it was brilliant. We loved it. And again, you know, we could have spoken for hours, but for the benefit of the podcast, we didn't. But no, we're really looking forward to speaking to Jude a little later. So thank you for joining us on the show. If you're new to what we do, well, we run a book company. We run a publishing services company called ArchPub. And we talk about the warts and all aspects of publishing. And we also reflect on the week's publishing news. And you have curated this week's news.
I love that. Makes it sound very posh.
It does.
So the first thing I think is worth talking about is from the London Book Fair. Mm. And as you know, I went last week or the week before, whenever it was. And one of the things I complained about while I was there was lack of chairs. Unless you have a meeting, there's nowhere to sit. However, there was an article in the bookseller this week that not only for the people like me who I did have a couple of meetings, but except for those times, but actually there were people who had arranged meetings and there weren't enough chairs.
They were having meetings on the stairs.
Mm. So imagine you're a publisher and you book a space with a table and a certain number of chairs, but actually you might have more than one of your staff having a meeting at the same time and fighting for the chairs. And I actually did witness this a little bit. So one of the meetings I had, the person I met had a table and two chairs, and she said to me, I just need to check that the table's free before we sit down. And it was, thank God, because I needed to sit down at that point. But that's the sort of thing that people have been complaining about. They're saying, you know, they're inviting people over from abroad to come to the London Book Fair, and it's embarrassing to say.
Absolutely. No, I think that's absolutely right. It is embarrassing. And if you think about what you pay for the ticket, so, you know, it's £75 for an attendant. The door has just gone and the delivery is made and we can continue the podcast. We did say it would be warts and all, and you don't get much more warty than Amazon arriving with weeding tools for the back garden.
I was going to say, as long as it's not wart cream.
No, it's not. So we were talking about London Book Fair. You pay £75 plus to attend and you've got nowhere to sit.
No, and the organisers of the fair did respond on this, and they said there are renovations going on at Olympia at the moment and it's difficult. They've got space issues and they're going to address the issue for future years.
Well, it's been an issue all the time we've been going.
Yes, it's always been an issue, hasn't it?
But it really has. And, you know, it's just really unsightly to have, you know, to people taking refuge and leaning against wall, you know, sitting against walls.
Well, we've sat on the floor. And this time I ate my sandwich on the floor.
Yeah. I know that they charge for chairs effectively, you know, if you've got a stand or whatever, you know, you have to rent your chairs. But it just seems wrong.
Mm.
And of course, the advantage for the big book companies who have these sprawling great stands with loads of meeting desks and coffee provided and catering and all that sort of thing is that they really look impressive.
Oh, no, you just look at Penguin Random House and it is a village basically in the middle of the the it's arena.
Well, okay, so LBF, some things to improve for next year. You know, let's hope they do it. But actually, on that theme of venues letting you down, or events, I've written to the AO Arena in Manchester. I attended an event this week, and you know, they shut the toilets before the thing had finished. It was just ridiculous. There were security and barriers and all sorts, shutting all the toilets. This is an arena that usually seats something like 18,000 people. There weren't as many in for this event in particular. It was more about 10,000, but still 10,000 of us left without the opportunity to go to the loo before we hit the streets.
That's a lot of liquid.
Yeah, I was very, 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 very angry at the time, and my son had to pull me away. It was embarrassing. Anyway, let's move on to our next story.
Yeah, so I tweeted about this in the week, but I think it's worth talking about as well. It's in the bookseller again. It was a survey of debut authors asking about their experience of publishing, their sort of first experience of publishing. It's quite a small pool of people, but it's still interesting.
How many people?
108 people responded.
Right. So that is quite small.
Yeah, and they came from a variety of backgrounds, you know, sort of the big five as well as small independent presses. But over half said that they felt that the experience was negative as opposed to positive.
Yeah.
You would go into it with a positive attitude,
of course,
I think.
Yeah, so yeah, yeah.
That is quite worrying, I think. They talk about expectations of a launch party. One person said that if a launch party was mentioned at all, they were expected to organise it themselves, and the publisher may offer to give them some money towards wine. So I'm not quite sure what they were expecting there. Because in the olden days, right, we're talking when I worked at OUP, we did have launch parties. And even then, it tended to be a collaboration in terms of the author might find the venue and they might pay for the venue, and then the publisher would pay for all the food and alcohol.
Yeah.
But nowadays, even less so. And these debut authors are sort of saying how surprised they are, how little support they got for launches. Also, communication was cited as an issue. Mm. One person even saying they felt there was gaslighting and fake conversations coming from their publisher. You know, like they would ask them something, and then instead of telling them the truth, they would make them feel like they were being a bit stupid, you know, asking the question or not quite telling the truth on the answer. And I hope that's not the case with us.
No, I don't think it is, but, you know, it's always a difficult relationship. You know, the initial thrill of being signed is understandable. But I think that, and I saw an article, a wider sort of newspaper article about following up this survey, saying essentially, look, authors have a rose-tinted view of how it's going to be propagated by Hollywood and drama.
Yes, yeah. So when there's in any film where there's an author,
oh yeah, there's always a book.
They have a tour, don't they, around Europe and things like that, and
all of that. You know, so I think there's unrealistic expectations as to what's involved. But I do think that one of the things that we tried to differentiate ourselves on, and it's not easy to be consistent about this, is to be more collaborative, certainly more honest and open about where things stand compared to, say, other publishers. But, you know, it still boils down to this, is that, you know, there's a new book out, actually, and I can't remember who it's by. I'll try and look it up for the second half of the show, that is basically saying, look, you're the only person who can market your book is the author themselves in the current market. You are the biggest selling point, and you need to get used to the idea that you're going to have to spend more time doing that and put in more work than you did to write the book. And now, that's not necessarily a fair way of putting it, but that is the cold reality, particularly around the big five, who will only spend a certain amount of money on a certain very small number of books, and the rest of them as we heard a few weeks ago, the average spend on a HarperCollins mid-list or low-list title in terms of advertising is £200, which is essentially someone sending out a press release.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, if that actually, yeah.
That might be, that actually might just be sending 10 review copies out. And that is basically £200. You know, you put your postage together and the cost of printing the books and whatever, you know, I have to say 10 copies, 20 copies, say. But, it, you know, that is the cold reality. And I think that in many ways, you know, we send publishing proposals, and we have done this week, and we're speaking to some authors who've went through our latest round of submissions, and I've been reading some more. Part of me thinks perhaps we should be a little bit more, you know, rather than this is what we aspire to do, actually say this is the cold reality, you know. And but it's really difficult because there is a thrill. It's a lifetime achievement for many, many people to get published. But I was listening to, or reading another article which featured another independent publisher who was talking about this issue. And he was saying, basically, I ask my authors, what did they write the book to achieve? What was their aim? And very few of them will ever say, oh, I want to be a bestseller, because that's kind of very, very, you know, it's a rarity rather than a guarantee. They will say, oh, I want to get my story out there. I wanted to get my voice heard. Well, you've achieved that by getting published.
Yeah.
Beyond that, you know, there isn't the chauffeur-driven limo. There's not going to be the big splash book launch for most, you know, apart from the top 1% of authors, if that. And I bet Ian Rankin doesn't bother doing them anymore. He does a book tour, but I bet there isn't a launch party for each of his books. So, you know, it is a lot tougher because there isn't the money in the publishing at the moment and the margin to be able to afford these things. I think actually it was John Barton from Vertebrate Publishing talking to
Joe Penn,
yeah, who's been a guest on of ours briefly at LBF last year. So, but he that was something he there was a they had a good section in that interview about how do you handle new first time authors and what messages do you need to pass on to them. And I think it's fair.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that the most interesting comment from one of these one of the people surveyed was that she had a book published which was about some trauma that she went through, and she was surprised that her publisher didn't pay for her therapy. So
yeah, okay, now that really is delusional.
That's a little bit too far, isn't it?
Perhaps that's not the right word for somebody who's suffered mental you know, issues over some trauma they've suffered, but let's be honest, that is just not realistic. Let's put it that way. Interesting.
Yes.
Well, no, it's a valuable survey. I shall look up the name of that book that has just come out that talks about, you know, the importance of authors recognizing they're in charge of their own marketing. That's not what we do here, but it's still really hard to make an impression. And I think the other thing I wanted to mention was that, look, we're going into a new era of publishing. And I was listening to another podcast, again, it was Joanna Penn's, where she's just come back from the 20 books to 50K conference that was held in Seville about 2 weeks ago. And there, the person organising it, Michael Andelay, who's very well known in indie publishing circles, has launched his publishing company, and he's published 350 books last year, and he wants to publish 700 this year. Then he changed it with ChatGPT version 4 coming out. He has now decided that using AI writing tools, his aim is for his publishing company to publish 10,000 books this year. 10,000 books using AI-generated plots and writing.
I don't understand, unless he's got a staff of about 200 people, how do they manage the logistics of just getting them on a platform to sell?
No, there is that. There is that, and that is obviously... I mean, he may have just been saying it to be provocative, but he doesn't do anything by halves. He's made a lot of money from independent publishing. And you know, I can see why people think, you know, if they're selling mediocre books as it is, and I would say a lot of those books coming out from that sort of stable are mediocre, but people buy them because they're marketed well, right?
Mm.
And they're right on genre, which is also something that is, you know, a growing reality is that if you really nail the beats of a certain genre and meet expectations, you can find an audience for it.
Yeah, because people like the familiarity of...
Absolutely. So you teach the algorithm, the AI algorithms, what the genre is, what the tropes are. You feed in a certain amount of information about the type of characters and the scenario, and you let it do the work.
Okay.
And then you go in and polish it, and it can take... he was saying that it takes that process, the way they've got it now, is they can write 80,000 words, which is ready for editing, in 3 hours.
I have a question, though.
Yes.
Right, so when you fall in love with a series, right? Mm-hmm.
Yep.
You also fall a little bit in love with the author, don't you?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then
yeah.
you follow them on social media. But there's no author in this case.
Well, yeah, but they'll fabricate one. I mean, look at, you know, it's the same with ghostwriting. You're often reading something which is supposedly by somebody and it's written by somebody else. It's the same process.
Yes,
it's just that you take the human element or reduce the human element hugely.
I agree with that. I accept that. But in the genres that we work in, the readers tend to want to meet and know the authors.
I don't dispute that, but I'm sure they could, just as Vladimir Putin has several people who walk around pretending to be him, okay. especially if he wants to go to the battlefront, it's somebody else, it's a body double.
So you're saying there's a very, very vague possibility, I accept that, but J.D. Kirk, who we interviewed, wasn't really a person.
No, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that you could easily get somebody to pose as that person.
Oh, yeah.
If that was important. But let's be honest, you know, the face-to-face interface with readers isn't that often. It's not everybody gets invited to a festival to talk about their work. And, you know, there's only certain names in the UK and that have that guaranteed following that people want to hear from. And that's why they're always the ones booked for every festival. If they can get hold of Anne Cleves, they get Anne Cleves.
Yeah, okay.
Or Ian Rankin or Val McDermid, who turns up to everything, pretty much. You know, because they do have followings. So I would argue that we are entering a new phase. And within that, going back to the original point, which is how do debut authors feel they're being handled? You're going in now, if you're a debut author in the next 2 years, into a world where there are people like Michael Anderley, who has the money and the nous to flood the market with books to a large degree generated by computers, and then the rest of it, the packaging, the marketing in terms of, you know, generating Facebook ads and Amazon or whatever it might be. And once something, you know, they stick out there, start selling, this is what we'll see. Is that you'll be able to get a weekly, you know, weekly book from said invented author.
Mm.
And if you're into romance or certain types of crime novel, that will suit you down to the ground. No waiting 6 months for the next one. If you know, that's when an author's writing quickly.
But isn't that as bad as, like, in space TV when they eat little cubes of dinner?
Look, yeah. Look, I'm not defending it. I'm just trying to present the forthcoming potential reality of publishing in the next 2 to 3 years, as I understand it, and what I've been looking across. It's the same argument I would make about the difference between human narration and AI narration, but the fact is that it'll get more and more sophisticated and very hard to distinguish. And I think non-fiction narration is going to be a thing of the past for humans to do.
Mm, no, I think that
you know, you have to be, and I think if you're a narrator who can just narrate with very few voices, again, is going to be, they're the people most in jeopardy.
Yeah, definitely, that's without a doubt.
Because if you can't create distinctive characters with your voice.
No, you're easily replaced by AI.
Absolutely, and, you know, that's something I work very hard at and, you know, continue to add to my portfolio of things I can do, but... You know, basically, I create characters that are distinctive from each other. And that's very important. I think that is a differential that AI is going to struggle until such time as they've got enough AI voices. And they say to ourselves, oh, this Scots character is from the east coast of Scotland, from wherever. We'll stick in this AI to cover that thing. And then, you know, you could do a multiple AI production.
How about this podcast, though? Do you think eventually that we could just say, we'll have an Adrian and we'll have a Rebecca and they're going to talk about these news items?
I love that. So we don't have to bother with this and argue over what's going into the programme and fall out with each other.
Yeah, we just press buttons and bingo.
It could happen. I don't think there's necessarily the big commercial drive towards that yet, but we'll see. Listen, we've taken enough of your time with one of our heated debates.
Oh, we have many.
We do. Yeah, we just don't get on anymore.
No, we're falling out at the moment quite a lot, actually.
We are. Okay, I'm going to give you the job of introducing our guest.
I think it's about time we talk to Jude Hayland, don't you? You can respond to that.
Oh, I can. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yes, we can. Yeah, well, as we mentioned, Jude is a veteran of the women's magazine market in the UK, 80s and 90s and the early 2000s. And then is now a novelist. And also she's been a creative writing teacher for many years as well. And so there's so many things to go at here, from going from short form 3,000 word stories with a particular formula to longer form novels. I think it was a fascinating interview. So let's talk to Jude Hayland.
What a great pleasure it is to speak to Jude Hayland. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
It really is a pleasure. And we can cover all sorts of aspects, but I really want to start with your career writing for women's magazines, because it's a fascinating world. And the first thing, you know, this is, we're talking about some years ago now, but this was quite a vibrant market for writers writing short stories for the likes of, I don't know, Bella, Women's Own, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
How did you fall into that? Was it something you set out to do?
I really did fall into it in a way. I first started to write nonfiction, just sort of amusing. I thought they were amusing, lighthearted articles. And the very first one I randomly sent off at the tender age of 19 to Brides magazine, all about my sister's wedding. And it was accepted. And I was so amazed. I was waiting for the rejection and the acceptance came. But then I thought, well, of course, this is easy. Well, 3 years later, when my second piece got accepted, I realised it wasn't quite so easy. It really was beginner's luck. So this went on for 2 or 3 years writing nonfiction. And then I was doing a degree and training to teach English. And I started teaching English. And one day I gave my class a story to write. And I was really envious of them. I thought, I want to write stories. I want to write fiction. So I just started, and again, very randomly started sending them off to women's magazines. And at the beginning was reasonably successful. There were so many, we're talking sort of 1980s, when the world was your oysters, Woman's Realm, Woman's Weekly, Woman's Own, Woman, etc. So I started selling quite a few, and then I got an agent. She wrote to me. Those were the days. She wrote to me via one of the magazines that she'd seen one of my stories. Could she take me out to lunch at the Cafe Royal in Regent Street? And I thought, oh, this is it. Abandon the teaching career. Well, of course, it's not quite like that, as any writer will tell you. But nevertheless, it was great because she took me on and I just sent her the stories. And not only did she have good contacts in the UK, but she sold a lot abroad. So I was then being translated into Norwegian, Swedish, Danish, Dutch, Australia, not in translation. And I sold quite a lot because she had these connections abroad. And that went on for quite a few years. If the length of stories varied, but about 2,500 to 3,000 words. Then gradually the demands became more prescriptive. It was down to, 1,500 words. Oh, it must be upbeat ending. It must have this ingredient, et cetera. And then some of the magazines started to go online only, and a lot started to close. So, Bella magazine as well. The Women's Weekly supplements, summer supplement, winter supplement, these kinds of things. They were good markets for a while. But again, I began to want to write greater length. So I started, was sort of into the 2000s, we're into the 21st century, very early 21st century. I did an MA in creative writing at Winchester, where I was now living, moved out of London. I'd had my son, life had moved on. And that really was the turning point for me for wanting to write at greater length. I was still doing the short stories as well, but again, the markets were closing down. And then my agent retired. And I thought, this is it. This is the moment to start thinking more seriously about longer length fiction. My first novel took me a long time, years. there's that feeling, can I even ever get to the end? And I kept on restarting, having different ideas, etc. But I did eventually finish it, but I didn't publish it And then I started a second novel. It's all a bit muddled because I then went back to my first novel. And over the space of 10 years, I have written now 3 novels, which isn't huge, but I've published over the last 6 years because I kept on refining and changing. I've got a bit speedier. We're now down to 2 years between novels. They're not exactly fast paced for these people who produce them every 6 months, but I think the nature of the novels I write and I edit and re-edit and re-edit again, and I am still doing bits of coaching, creative writing, bits of teaching English, bits of teaching drama on a freelance basis now. I've completely left the conventional school teaching. But I am a slow writer. I'm not one of these, right, I'm going to write 5,000 words this morning before lunch. I can't do that.
But I've just been thinking, there's a chance I could have read one of your stories, because I remember in the 80s, reading the short stories in my mum's magazines, and I used to love them.
Well, you could well have done, yes. Actually, in fact, I wrote under my birth name, which is Wilson, Judith Wilson, I used to write under. Hayland is my sort of adopted novel writing name. It's actually a family name, but it's not the name I used to write the magazine short stories. But yes, if you picked up Women's Weekly.
Every week I used to read them. So, yeah, it's very possible.
We definitely cross paths, so to speak. Yes.
Yeah. I think it's a shame, isn't it, that sort of that part of the writing industry has declined so much.
Well, I think it's true of all the magazines are suffering. Yes. In fact, I was in contact with someone I went to journalism school with, and she has featured. I mean, her career has been around the women's weeklies. And she said that she's got to the point now, she's what, 51 or something, there is nothing, there are no places for her work to go anymore. They're all shut. It's tragic.
So sad. It really is, because it was a great market. It really was. And at one stage I was, you know, every month I had something in a magazine in the UK, let alone abroad. But no, it's just disappeared. And now there's Women's Weekly, but you had to be taken on by them. And then they hold on to your stories, is the other thing, for about a year, so you can't sell it elsewhere. No, it has disappeared as a market, which is very sad, yes.
But presumably the thirst is still there. I mean, in terms of these sort of stories,
or,
you know, there's an audience for this stuff.
Well, I'm sure there is. And actually, just last year, I produced, just as an ebook, some of my revamped, I went through all my copies of my old magazines, the stories I had in there, and I reproduced just as an ebook under a different pseudonym, because I didn't want to confuse with my novels, Polly Dodd, some of those stories, because there are, and the people have read them, said, oh yes, sometimes I just want a quick sort of 10 minute over a cup of coffee, an easy story that's not going to tug too much at your heartstrings, but well written. That's always the criteria, you want it well written. And yeah, I'm sure there is a market for them, but I don't know, it's not being served unless they buy my ebook.
Of course, Polly Dodd is the the nom de plume for that.
Yes,
I think it's fascinating though. I mean, I'm always fascinated by switching from shorter form to longer form as a challenge, because clearly when you're writing those sort of, you know, with those sort of prescriptive word counts, 2,500, 3,000, even less than that, obviously, was the sort of move that you've mentioned. That's one heck of a challenge to deliver, you know, a story that satisfies in that time. And yet, yes, when you're expanding into a longer format, like a novel, then those challenges are suddenly taken away. But at the same time, that is a challenge in itself.
Yeah.
But you haven't got those restrictions. It's about self-discipline then.
Absolutely. And that was when I started writing my first novel. On the one hand, it was great because you could develop the characters, you could have their backstory, which you really haven't got time for a backstory, or it's got to be minimal or really majorly contribute to the main premise of the short story. So you could develop all that. But on the other hand, I remember getting to about halfway through and thinking, oh my God, I've got all these characters, I've got to get them up there every day. Do I get their teeth cleaned? Do you know, have I got to get them dressed? You suddenly have this sort of weight of responsibility to the lives of your characters. And then of course you realize, well, no, think of what you read. You don't see these characters every single day. But and then there's that danger of sort of making a soggy middle of a novel, that you're just treading water with it, because you can't go from here to there to your sort of climax the way you can quickly with a short story. So yeah, I mean, it's swinging some roundabouts. There's kind of great advantages to being able to write at length. But there's also that sense of, can I make the story last long enough? Especially if you're not writing something with an obvious, yeah, if you're writing crime fiction and you've got to find out who done it, as it were, it's a little bit different. But the sort of thing I write, where there is a sort of mystery, but it's more a mystery of sort of family secrets and this kind of thing, the actual plotting is quite hard, which is why I think I edit, I re-edit, I replan and go back to the beginning again constantly, because I'm not very good at planning everything ahead of time. I could with short stories. I write, okay, first paragraph's going to be this, middle, then it's going to be this, then it's going to be that, and my conclusion's that. But with a novel, I know how it's going to begin, and I know what's going to happen, and I know how it's going to end, but I don't know how I'm going to get there. Mm. And that's probably the main difference from writing short stories, you know, your fixed length, where you've got to know, because you haven't got, you can't go many side routes to get there.
No, because you run out of space.
But I presume that when you were writing for magazines, I mean, you know, you were being paid by your output, in the sense that you had to get some words down on a regular basis. And you knew also that some would land and some wouldn't.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting that in probably in that part of your career, you were writing quite quickly and having to be quite direct. But with novel writing, it's been a bit more of a meander.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I did. I mean, at one stage in the kind of, I think in the 80s or early 90s, I was teaching 4 days a week and really writing on a Friday and producing a story Friday and over the weekend. It was finished by the end of the weekend. I got an idea. Yes, it had to come. And yeah, because there weren't great levels in these, and there weren't that many characters. You couldn't have too many characters, otherwise you're going to confuse your reader. So I could write quite quickly then. And obviously I'd edit. But then you knew there wasn't any point in editing too much, because it would end up getting edited and you knew they'd throw out the words. And I wasn't so precious about that. Once it had been accepted, I like to see it in the magazine. It's quite exciting getting to Smith's, and there it is. If you got to Smith's before they sent you a copy. In those days, they used to send you a copy, which was nice.
Wow.
Page, yes. But I wasn't so protective of it, put it that way. I got my check by then, again, the days of checks, and that was fine. And I was on to the next one, and I'd even probably forgotten what I'd written in that story. But it is different. You are more precious about the ridiculous amount of time you put into novel writing. But I don't have to do it.
No. It's interesting that, you know, the limitations that you've got in that format. In terms of characterization, you've got to land characters quite quickly. It must be very difficult not to slip into just tropes and the cliche.
Exactly. And to a certain extent, the magazines actually want cliches.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But I think what you can do is avoid the cliches in the style of writing. So even if your type is, they want, I mean, they would say, we want them to be this age range, preferably family. They weren't very keen on divorce at that time. It was slightly dodgy. Weren't very okay. Extramarital affairs, more really, since the 80s. But so I was willing to go along with that because they were going to pay me. But as I say, the quality of the writing still mattered. And as long as the cliches aren't in the language, that was okay.
So I guess things like dialogue were crucial in that sense.
Yeah. Quite a lot of dialogue, yes. And you had to identify the style. I mean, it's actually a very good discipline when I think about it now, a very effective discipline, which I find I've sort of lost. I have done a bit of flash fiction, which gets you back to it. And flash fiction almost reminds me of that sense of having to find the character in the opening paragraph, otherwise you've lost interest. And they've always all got to be fairly likable. Whereas they can't have so many sort of light and shade as the characters in your novels can. I mean, my most recent novel, there's a character who, at the beginning, she's quite objectionable. And then I allow a little, you know, slightly warmer tones for her. But you haven't got time. They've either got to be nice or not so nice, or they've got to quickly see errors of their ways in the magazine stories, because basically they do want decent, upright characters. At least they did then. I'm a little, I think probably more so now, but yes.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it's much more blurred now. I'm interested to know about your mindset when you went in to do your MA, because you've been writing professionally and been commissioned and read internationally, and you're putting yourself back into an academic environment. You've been teaching in school. That's quite a challenge, isn't it? To open yourself up to a criticism.
Be a student
again. And that must have been hard.
It was hard, but I love being a student. Somebody else is preparing the lessons. Even now, you know, I love going to somebody else. And you think, oh, they've spent all evening, all weekend planning that. So that was great. And, you know, I'm this perpetual student. I love my notebooks, and every writer does, and the new pens, you know, and all this is before iPads and all this rubbish, you know. So I love that aspect of it. I did it over 2 years. So it was, you know, part time because I was teaching, and my son was young at the time. He was sort of 6, 7 when I started it. So it was lovely. My one evening, Monday evening, 6 till 9 of like going to the library again. I loved all that part. Being criticized, yes, I had to learn to take criticism. And that was actually possibly the thing I gained mostly, because it taught me to be far more self-critical. It really did. Because with the magazines, either your story was accepted or not. And that was it. They were either going to take it because it suited what they wanted that month or week, or they didn't. So you didn't really feel your integrity as a writer was being questioned. It was just the market didn't suit the market. And actually, it was great because I did become so much more self-critical, willing to write 6,000 words and then tear them up and start from the beginning, things like that, which even with the story, I wasn't. Once I'd written 1,500, I'd keep going, you know. That was great. And I did learn so much. In a way, people say you can't teach anyone to write. And no, you can't. But I think it's the whole experience of realizing. I remember after the first session or two thinking, this is fantastic. I'm in a room with people who for 3 hours just think writing is the most important thing that they're doing with their week, you know, apart from loving their children and all that stuff. And so it was that sense of you were allowed to believe in what you were doing. People were taking it seriously, and they wanted to sit down. You know, the tutors were wanting to sit down for an hour with you and discuss how you could improve the piece of writing. And that was really precious. And as I say, it did me a great deal of good of learning to be very, very hard on myself and far more self-critical. It took me a very long, you know, 2 years, Steph, but it took me a very long time to finish my dissertation. I have to say, I didn't do that in 2 years because that was 20,000 words. And as I say, my son was young and I was working full time. But when I eventually did it, that sense of somebody saying lovely things about it and saying it was the first 20,000 words of a novel. And the comment at the end was, this is really worth pursuing. So that was great. The accolade from that, and I got a distinction, so that was very exciting.
And did you pursue it? Is that one of your novels? Or
I did. It's actually ended up being my second novel, curiously enough, because I just felt I was too close to it and I put it aside. And actually I think it gained in that, because I did go, but it became my second novel. Yeah, so that was The Legacy of Mr. Jarvis, which was a different name from the dissertation. But yeah, that was that sense that somebody thinks I'm worth reading was great. Was from published authors. That was lovely.
Oh, that is fantastic. I admire anybody who goes back into education. I mean, to be honest, it's funny because, you know, when you were talking about new pens, it reminded me, I had a dream last night that we'd moved to the South Coast.
Yeah.
And we were living, and we had new pens. Hoback was based next to a stationery shop, and it was like,
heaven.
So we've got the beach and we've got a stationery shop. It couldn't get any better, really.
Yeah. So I also did an MA. I did fine art.
Fantastic. Yes.
Similar situation. Children were fairly young when I started. So it was that sort of juggling. But the joy of being in a room with no distractions with somebody who wants to talk about art.
Yes, it takes you seriously in what you're doing. I know, it was fantastic. It really, really good. No, very precious time. Yes,
absolutely. And so we've actually touched on this a number of times in this interview, talking about your self-critical approach and re-editing. Do you ever get frustrated with yourself to say, look, it's good enough, leave it? Does that get to a point? Does a book get abandoned in your world rather than finished, if you know what I mean?
I think you always feel that. I always think you have inside you, before you start, the idea of the book, this is going to be better than anything I've ever done. And when you get to the end, you go back, it's never quite as good as you hoped it would be. But you get to the point, in fact, I'm at that point now with my fourth novel. And just this morning, just before we started this interview, I've got to the end of what really I think should be my final edit, because I actually finished it quite a while ago, I mean, like September. And I've gone back and cut. I've cut now 7,000 words, and I don't think I can cut much more. And I think I'm just doing one more read through, but try and skim through it. And then I've got to think, enough is enough. Because I don't think it isn't ever finished. And once my novels are out there in paper form, I can't look at them, because I know as soon as I do, I will think, oh God, that's not the right word. It's a better word than that. And I do agonize over words. And the voice inside me is thinking, the reader might even skip over this sentence, because you know how you do talk to yourself. I want to get to the end of the chapter before I turn out the light, go to sleep. And you think, but it's got to be as good as it can be at that moment.
Yeah, you've got to feel yourself, haven't you, that it's as good as you could get it. But it is difficult to know that point. I think a lot of writers struggle to know when to stop and put the pen down.
And it is very difficult. And I don't think you're ever absolutely sure. But I think when I was getting to the end, just the last few days, knowing I was just about to, this bank holiday, we've got three bank holidays, so now I'm going to try and get it finished this bank holiday. I think I need to leave these characters. I'm getting the slightest bit tired of these characters. I want some new ones. And I think that's the point when, if you think, oh, I've got to read it again, and thinking, and you know, rather than thinking, I want to look at it again, I want to make sure that all ties up. And I will then send it off to an editor who will then pick me up on things. But I think I've got to the point somebody else's eyes now need to be on it. I think I'm going to try and send it off.
I totally understand that. Yeah. It's in terms of those characters. I was listening to an interview you have done previously, and you have a very rich appreciation of how to make characters work and to develop their motivations and how those rub against each other is the sense I got anyway. Yeah. How much of the process of your writing is built around building in your head those characters?
Everything, really. Yeah, my novels are character driven, and I start with characters and what happens to them. That's always, it's characters first, plot second. I mean, obviously there's a plot. They're not just character descriptions, but it's the importance and the vividness of the characters. I suppose I think you tend to write what you like reading yourself, if that makes sense. Mm. And if I can't believe in a character, don't feel they're well-rounded, I'm probably going to give up on the novel. And if I don't find something, I don't have to like the characters, but I've got to find them interesting. Their motivation, why they behave, or why they think they can behave as they do. So yes, I mean, each novel has started with a character or an idea. Apart from possibly my second novel was about, well, it's still character-based, but it was about something, a story I'd heard about somebody years and years before, and that story had never left me, but it was still driven by a character. And certainly my most recent one, I remember seeing this woman three years ago, I was on a bus going to Islington to meet my son, where he was working at the time. And I looked out of the bus and there was this woman standing at the bus stop. And I remember thinking, oh, she's going to be the character, my principal character, my next novel. It just sort of came to me like that. And then I built from there. Absolutely. Yeah.
I like the idea. There's this woman wandering around. Has no idea she's in a book.
No idea. Her fame. Exactly.
Yes. It's interesting because that comment just triggers some memory that I was watching a documentary some years ago, and this was Pete Townsend of The Who playing guitar as a guest of Mick Jagger on his whatever solo album. Yeah. And they were having this conversation, and Pete Townsend says, yeah, I take the district line, because they were living in Richmond, the both of them at the time. I take the district line occasionally. It's really good to see real people. It's very inspiring. You should try it, Mick. And you're thinking Mick Jagger sitting on a district line.
But, might do.
But there's someone who's massively creative. And yes, probably if he puts a beanie hat on, he'd probably be able to hide Pete
Townsend. That's interesting because I was on the district line a lot yesterday. I didn't see him.
No. No. <beanie hat. laughs> I think they're on tour at the moment.
But, that's the screen I was.
But yes. It is something that I miss because we live in sticks and there's no public transport.
What, you miss the district line?
No, well, I miss public transport because it is a fascinating thing.
There are buses. You could just get on a bus.
Well, yeah, but buses not great, really, too. Are there? I mean, you know, these are buses to Telford.
Yeah, a bus. To, you could get on the bus to Telford. You see some life on that bus.
People live in Telford, yes, yeah. No, I agree. I mean, it's just the people watching, which I love, and overhearing conversations. You know,
I used to keep a notebook, and I used to make notes of people's conversations because they were fascinating.
Yes. I was on the train the other day going up to London, and these two people were talking, and he was going to Gatwick and was talking about difficulty or not sure where to get off and which platform the train would be at to get from Clapham to Gatwick. And I found myself starting to tell him. And then I remember thinking, oh my God, I'm not supposed to be listening. Just because I know which platform. I'm thinking, and I went, it turned into a sort of cough because they were sort of sitting just down from me. But I'd heard everything, you know. But you do have to suddenly think, I'm not supposed to know about their life and the fact that his wife is spending her weekend in Scotland while he's going off to Switzerland to ski, you know. But yeah, you do gain a lot. Public transport's good for that.
It is like breaking the fourth wall, isn't it, if you interrupt a conversation like that. I sometimes do it too.
Recently, when we were on holiday, so there was a couple, there was a woman, two women at a table near us. We were in a cafe in Rye in Sussex, and she'd just lost her father, I think it was, and she was telling the other woman about how, you know, the sort of funeral arrangements and the grieving, and then all this stuff came out about her childhood, and I was sat there thinking, oh my God.
Yes, exactly.
And that would have been perfect for a book, you know. Absolutely. That story.
Yeah, take notes. Completely. Well, funnily enough, I've got to the age where I'll just start talking to people. I mean, you're never going to see them again, so if they think you're a nutter, it doesn't matter. But I was in a shop yesterday, and there was this woman, older woman, clearly, and she was with about 15, 16-year-old who kept saying, oh, Granny, that you look lovely in that coat. She was in Zara. She was trying all these coats on. And the grandma was saying, I'm not sure, whatever. She said, no, it's lovely, it's lovely. And I just tapped the woman on the shoulder and said, you're so lucky to have a lovely granddaughter like that, aren't you? And the woman said, oh, thank you so much. Of course, the 16-year-old granddaughter looked at me with loathing, as if, how, you know, you don't speak to strangers like that.
Yeah.
Why not talk to people? You know, then I moved on. But we've got this kind of sense of you mustn't talk to anybody. And actually, most people of a certain age quite like it. It's only if you're, you know, under 20, you probably, why are you talking to me? So, yeah, I would do it. I mean, not probably asking about her late father, but you can pick up the material and use it, which is great. Yes.
Totally.
I mean, I do it all the time, and I've my three boys, so they're let me think, 19, 17 and 13, and they always go, oh, why did you talk to the person at the till?
Exactly. You're imitating my son, who's now 28. He could just say yes. Yeah.
Well, in fairness to your youngest boy, he's learned the trick that I've taught him, which is to read people's name badges if they're wearing them at the supermarket or in boots or whatever.
He doesn't go, oh, Sandra, thanks.
Well, yeah.
And peer at her, like.
And thank them by name, because that'll make their day every single time.
Absolutely. And actually, I have to say, I'm saying that with my son, but he's great with people and he has to be very good with clients in his job. So maybe my sort of curiosity about people, he's picked up on. We hope they learn.
I'd like to think so.
Yeah.
In terms of teaching writing, then, what are the things that you see most often that, what are the sort of beginner errors, if that's the right way of putting it, you know, when someone's embarking, we get a lot of submissions. So this is actually something I need to focus on later today, is to get into our submissions pile. And you can see the difference very, very quickly between someone who thinks they're writing what publishers want to read and actually writing something with X factor quality, something different.
Yeah.
So what would you say? I mean, in all your experience of teaching English, where do people go wrong, do you think?
I think one of the first things they go wrong is trying to imitate a writer they like. They think, oh, this writer is selling millions. They're the bestseller of this, that, and the other. I'll try and write like them. It's that cliche of finding your own voice, but I think that is true. I think it's the hardest thing in the world, criticizing, especially adults, or trying constructive criticism, because we are very protective of everything we write. It is, after all, you know, our souls there on the page. It is hard. But that, I think, is the number one error. Seeing their goal of selling millions for a start and thinking, how does that, you know, how do they write? I'll imitate their style. I think one of the kind of more functional things people often get wrong is point of view. Writing from all sorts of points of view, and confusing them. That's kind of that's easier to correct and easier to point out, because it doesn't feel quite so personal. And I do think sometimes people just haven't read. I think I often say to people, when you're reading, you say, do you read a lot? Oh, yeah, I read a lot. But do you read as a writer? What works and why is it working? Why do you enjoy that novel so much? What do you admire in it? Not because you're going to try and copy it, but what is the quality that that writer has that you want to aim for in your own voice, in your own tone? So it's a mixture. Copying, imitation is the number one error, I think, when somebody starts. Point of view. And then sometimes just, and I know I'm guilty of this, and I edit it out, saying the same thing several times. I'm trying to say, you only need to say it once. The reader doesn't need to know everything. And obviously it's the other cliche thing of show, don't tell. Okay, some of the things you do have to tell, but you don't have to keep telling. And if you can show rather than saying the clock's hand moved to whatever, he heard the clock chime, or whatever it happens to be, or the show not tell is a big one. But I do think you have to be incredibly sensitive and delicate, I found. The first class I did with adults, it's easier with younger ones. You feel that sense of authority. I'm many years older than you, I've lived longer than you. But when you're teaching adults, and they are, understandably, you've got to be very delicate. So it is often thinking, is this really how you want to write? Why do you write, for a start? I think people should go back to that. Yeah, you want to tell a story. Why do you like telling stories? And I always say, when people say, why do I write? They'll often say, because I want to understand. I want to understand people. I want to understand emotions. I want to understand why I react to things the way I do. And the longer you've been alive, my novels are all set in the recent past, well, recent to me. My last novel, this one I'm writing now, is set in 1983, and I like looking back. So there is a need to understand. And I think if people sort out why they're writing, not to be like another writer, if they say they're writing to make money, well, forget it.
That's true.
Very few make huge amounts. So that's the first lesson I would say to a new class. If you think you're writing to write, I mean, they might be lucky, they might be the very one. It's a bit like acting. It's like any art, painting, music. You're doing it because you have to, but your day feels better if you've written. So sorting out priorities, why are you writing? Not because you want to write like somebody else, but because you feel you have to write. And then I'm waffling a little bit here, but as I say, not copying, finding what your point of view is, that's kind of more structural. And then feel happy writing. Don't think crime is selling really well at the moment, I'd better write crime. Because if you don't read crime and you don't love reading crime and you don't love writing it, it's going to be completely hopeless. And I think that's often what trips people up, writing what they think is selling, which would be lovely if you could do it well. But it doesn't necessarily make for a good book.
No, but there's a lot of people out there saying that's exactly what you should do. You write to market, and
if you want to make money, though.
Yeah, and but this is a whole side of the industry which is doing nobody any favors, frankly, apart from the people who are propagating this, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. This writing to market, I mean, it would be great if we could do it well, but the trouble is, and also the market moves on all the time.
If you write by the time you've written it, it'd be something different.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure it's the same if you write for TV or whatever. I mean, I can't write scripts, so I don't know how script writers approach it. you would have to be incredibly clever, incredibly versatile, and very swift if you could write to market, I think. And you probably still need huge amounts of help. I mean, I know there are writers who try and write to market and they work with an editor and they go chapter by chapter, they send their first chapter, editor says, well, make these changes, send it back. But it's a different kind of writing. Yeah, I couldn't do it, but I don't know. There probably are some people successfully doing it out there, so I'm not decrying it. Great. They're lucky if they can do it and make a lot of money out of it, but it's not something you just set out to do, I don't think. You're lucky if what you write happens to hit the market at that moment.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot of luck involved, isn't there?
I think that's with all creative aspects, and I think that anybody who thinks that there's a formula, which a lot of people do put books out there saying this is the formula, and courses.
People like formula, though, don't they?
Well, they do tick box, and we are a little bit in that era in education as well, I'd say, you know, teaching this, teaching this, teaching that, tell them to put that down and then they'll get a top grade. But yeah, it's not a way to do something you love.
No.
I can't anyway.
Well, my middle son, I was actually talking to him, he's doing A-levels at the moment, and I said, he reads a lot. He reads a book a week or two books a week sometimes. And I said, do you ever wish you did English? Because he did history, economics, politics and art. And he said, well, yes, kind of. But I don't think I could cope with all the other stuff that you have to do in order to pass the exam. I just want to read books.
Yes. The analysis, it's a bit like, I mean, I love doing an English degree, but I have to say I loved the one area I hated criticizing was poetry. I love poetry, but I don't want to pull it to pieces. No. I don't mind pulling novels to pieces, actually, funny enough, and I think that was very helpful, but not poetry. I just want to sit there and wallow in it. Mm. I don't want to say why this metaphor works. It speaks to me. So you're right. And sadly, exams have got so much more prescriptive and I can't see them changing anytime soon.
No, I fear that's right. Now, Jude, behind you, you have your wonderful bookshelf, bookshelves. I'm interested to know which of the books there has been the most influential on you.
Well, the writers I love, I mean, I 19th century writers, I love George Eliot, Jane Austen, all that stuff, as it were, which I have taught, Thomas Hardy. But the contemporary writers, I love writing I should use modern and contemporary. I should use that because these people get older. Penelope Lively. Anita Bruckner, more contemporary, Anna Quinlan, Carol Shields, a lot of American writers, actually, Anne Tyler, Margaret Forster. They're the names which are springing to mind really quickly. They're the sort of novels that I love reading. I have just finished Claire Keegan, who to me read this
I've
yesterday.
I've read it. It's great, isn't it? It's absolutely amazing. Brilliant.
I have to say, she's the sort of writer I read that and think, why do I even bother trying? I read that on the train to London yesterday, on the District Line, and on the train home.
Yeah, it's a quick read, but it's so powerful. And that's what I like in a short book. You know, I don't particularly like reading 500-page epics.
No.
I would rather read something like that that you read, in a day, and then it doesn't leave you because you're so...
I woke up with it this morning. I mean, just the writing is just so wonderful. But yes, those are the sort of writers. I mean, after this, I shall think of hundreds more, but the kind of, you know, and I didn't mention any male writers, and I do, there's a huge number of, you know, Ian McEwan, obviously. I've forgotten. I have to look at their names, but a lot. William Boyd, that kind of novel, I suppose, character-driven.
They're good storytellers, aren't they? And like you say, characters, are very memorable characters.
Storytellers, and I'm not good at reading. I shouldn't say I'm not good at reading. I'm not very keen on novels without punctuation, novels which are too experimental. I mean, obviously, I read James Joyce and all that stuff back then, which now wouldn't seem experimental compared with some of the novels out there. I don't like gimmicks. Well, I shouldn't say that. I don't like novels which to me feel gimmicky. But that's just me. I like sentences and inverted commas. And
yes, yes, I'm very fond of those two. And if there's one book in terms of the process that you go back to, is there one that you the creative process, the writing process?
What, like a how-to?
Yeah, well, not so much. Yeah, something like that, I guess.
Well, I did read all those how-to books when I was doing my degree, and one written by Amanda, and her surname is eluding me, and she was my tutor, and that's terrible. It's an unusual surname. But I can remember one of the most useful things she said in it, which has never left me, is start your novel, lead the first chapter, write the second chapter, then go back and see if you even need that first chapter. Sometimes, and I've never forgotten that. And that was the most useful lesson I learned from her book, which I think was called with a very unusual title of Writing a Novel. I do believe it's in the house somewhere, but I won't go off and look for it. I think it was called Writing a Novel, and it came out about the time I was doing my dissertation. And I certainly found that very useful, because I do think it's true that we often start and then realise we don't need all that stuff, or we might need it later, but it's not a good hook at the start. So that was a lesson. I did read all the names which now elude me because I had to quote them in my dissertation, and they were useful. Some of those American tomes. I mean, I wasn't so keen on the sort of French philosophical postmodern ideas about this, that, and the other. Just the practical ideas, things like that. Decide where the start of your story really is. There's no need to start it ages before.
No, that's fair enough. That's fair enough. Right, I think we have reached the point where, it's pressure on everybody, really.
You always pick it up like that. It's really not that big a deal.
I beg to differ. Anyway, I will give it the big vocal build up.
You have
Rebecca's random question.
We've been watching MasterChef.
I have seen some of
them. So I would like to know, what is the poshest thing you've ever eaten, and did you enjoy it?
Oh.
That's a great question.
Probably, that's an interesting question, isn't it? Because I am not hugely good at posh food. I love food. I think the poshest thing were oysters. And I thought, what a waste of money. Very chewy. I mean, why bother? Have squid instead. And I've had lobster. That's, again, probably the poshest, quite a while ago. But I would rather be at a Cretan taverna on the beach eating a really good plate of the best sea bream ever, because it was swimming that morning. This is going to be horrific to people who don't eat anything which breathes or moves, but or a good plate of chicken souvlaki watching the Mediterranean there. It's the setting as much as the food. But probably lobster is the most, or I remember going back, talking ages ago, to the 90s when cuisine mansur, when you had a huge plate with the smallest bit of food ever, beautifully arranged, and you ate it and received a huge bill and went home starving hungry and opened the fridge and had a cheese sandwich. So I'm not very good at posh food, but yes, I have had lobster, I have had oysters, which I wouldn't bother to have them again. And I had snails once. I only had them because I didn't realize what they were. Somebody actually said, taste this with your eyes closed, and I said, oh, it's like a spicy mushroom, what was it? And he then said, oh, it was a snail. I was like, well, forget it.
Yeah, you absolutely would not touch any of those items, would you?
I have tried an oyster, and it was in Japan, and I remember thinking, why would you want to eat that? It tastes horrible.
Exactly.
It feels horrible.
Yeah.
And it lives in a shell. It should be living in its shell somewhere else.
Exactly. I mean, the sensation of was not great. I mean, give me a plate of vegetables any day. I mean, I am not vegan by any means, because I love cheese. and milk in my cappuccino, but you know, no. And also, even when I'm eating fish, I'd rather not see that it looked like a fish. That's terrible to say, but you know what I mean.
I'm the same. I say to him, I'll eat anything as long as it's not slimy, has tentacles or eyes.
Exactly. If it's some nice cod in a sauce, that will do me. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I because you spend quite a lot of time in Crete, don't you? So, which is wonderful. And there is something about eating at a Greek taverna which elevates anything in that environment, and the taste is just much better.
Funny enough, talking about MasterChef, last summer we were at a taverna in Seaside Resort near our house. We have a family house there. And, oh, what's his name? One of the judges from MasterChef was sitting there eating.
Did he have hair or was he the bald one?
He's the one with a very attractive wife because she was there with him.
That's John Turow, who's married to Lisa Faulkner. Yes,
that's the one. That was the cover because my sister and I were getting up. We think it's so we're getting on our phone. You can imagine, you know, trying to, our sons were with us at the time, getting hugely embarrassed. For goodness sake, which phone's around? He can probably see that you're Googling to make sure it's him. But he was eating at the same taverna as us and he went back another night. So obviously, he was actually eating a meat at the time, a sort of large steak, which my son went on to order. I think it was the most expensive thing on the menu. But yes, so there you are. He obviously recommends, you know, by his patronage of the place.
Absolutely. Well, you know, he's always famous for going. Now, I understand, you know, sort of, but yogurt with such and such?
Well, the funny thing was that we then spoke to the owner of the taverna when we left. He spoke in English and we said, do you realise who that was? He's very famous in England. And he said, well, only because people have told me. But he said he came in a week ago and asked for a table. I didn't know who he was. So I told him I had to send him away. I said, no, you'll have to go somewhere else. It's probably the first time he's ever been turned away from a taverna.
Yeah, from a restaurant, because, most restaurants would be like, yes, come in, here's my
produce. He went back several times after. And always
fantastic. Well, there you go. Good. That's it.
What's the poshest thing you've ever eaten?
Oh,
you've eaten a lot of posh stuff. He likes lobsters and things like that.
Yeah, look, I think the most memorable posh meal I ever had is I flew to France with a mate of mine when we were younger, in our 20s, both working at the BBC. And he said, we can get on the Ryanair flight to Biarritz for about £5 or whatever it was in those days. And he said, I booked us into a Michelin star restaurant in Bayonne or somewhere.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. And it was amazing. And it was the first time I had ever had foie gras, which obviously is very evil, but it was life-changingly rich and just delicious. I mean, you know, it just blew my mind actually to have that. And that's where they make it most. So
yes.
You do like that stuff, don't you?
Yeah. I do. So that meal was particularly memorable. I've probably eaten in posher places occasionally. But in terms of landing taste, it was just magnificent.
But then posh and taste aren't necessarily together, are they?
No.
You can have a really good middle level meal that's much nicer than little itty bits on a plate.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I want to feel I've eaten. I don't, you know, I don't like things which are sort of arranged too beautifully, because as soon as you put your fork in, you're going to spoil that picture anyway, you know.
Yeah.
I don't mind with the pudding, you know, and that's quite nice to look at the plate. But all this taking photographs and putting them on Instagram, I just eat it.
Yeah. I think the definition really for posh is not so much what the food is as the environment and the way that the attitude of the people that you're around.
Completely. Absolutely. It is.
So if you go to, I don't know, I have eaten at Gordon Ramsay's Chelsea restaurant, the one that has the 3 stars and is, you know, regarded as one of the best in London. And there it is very much the city banker types turning up and buying a bottle of Petrus for $14,000. And when I asked for the house white, it was like, you what?
Right, yeah. I think there's part of me that always thinks, think what I could have done with this money. And it is, you know, I could buy something that I could look at every day. But yeah, the experience is those little details. I mean, just, some restaurants that just do it well. And if you go out for a special birthday or something, it's lovely to have an occasion and you're willing to spend a bit more for that, just for that awful word, ambiance. And yeah, not sort of groveling at you and is that all right? But just judging the situation right. Yeah, absolutely. That's what you pay for.
Well, I think that's a good place to leave.
Yeah, it's almost time to have a posh lunch. Sandwich.
Yeah,
spoilers. Judy, it's been absolutely fantastic to speak to you, and we're very grateful. Where can people find you online?
Well, I've got a website and I'm on Amazon, so www.judehalens.co.uk. If you just put Jude Halens into Google, you should come up with my website, and it books for sale on Amazon, both as ebooks and real concrete actual books. So it's pretty easy to find me there.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much as well. It's been great talking. Have a lovely long bank holiday weekend.
Really enjoyed that interview. Really, really did. And let's think ahead to our next guest.
Yeah, so we're talking to a writer called Matt Adcock this week, coming
and
for next week's podcast.
He is an author in the cyberpunk genre.
I know, and I don't really know what that is.
Well, we're going to find out then, aren't we?
When I think of cyberpunk, I think of those people who go to festivals like the one we've just been to, the Norbury Canal Festival.
We have been to the Norbury Canal Festival.
With dark clothes, but lots of sort of shiny belly things, and they're cyber something, aren't they?
I don't know. Is that steampunk?
Steampunk, that's what I'm thinking of.
Yes, you are, yeah.
That different?
No, I mean, a steampunk environment would be, you know, if you're living on a narrow boat or something like that. There's a bit of that, but there's a lot of folky thing there, and there's lots of sort of fairy art going on as well. And it's a lovely festival. It's just across the field from where we are. That field now chewed up by all the car parking, unfortunately. So the cows won't have that back this summer. It was delightful. But Matt is joining us for this next show. So again, it's an opportunity. We've spoken to all sorts of people from different areas of writing, and it's always a fascinating, you know, just lifting the shutters on a different side of it. So we look forward to speaking to
him. And we're gaining so many friends. I feel like I've got so many new friends now from the last.
Well, yeah, the way I look at it, years. Yeah, absolutely. We go to a certain festival, we've got a lot of drinks to buy.
you look at it in a very negative way.
No,
we're going to get bought lots of drinks.
Well, maybe. That's lovely. We ought to congratulate Robert Dawes, Uncle Bob, for completing his UK tour of Woodhouse in Wonderland. That you remember, we went to see him at Theatre 7 in Shrewsbury. Which is quite early in the run, and now several months later.
He's just finished, isn't he?
He's just finished, and his final run of dates, I think it was in York and Yeovil.
Yeovil was the last one I saw.
Yeah.
And actually, a very interesting person was in the audience at the Yeovil one.
Oh, really?
Yes. So the great-grandson of Woodhouse himself.
Oh, wow. Well, that's fantastic. And the tour, from what I've seen, has gathered momentum, and more, you know, the ticket sales going up and up. So congratulations, Bob. I know it's a labour of love.
And to William Humble as well.
And William Humble, and indeed the whole team behind it. Because, wow, I mean, a one-man show. Quite demanding show.
Yes.
Very moving and very funny.
Yeah, we loved it. And we took two of the boys, and they didn't know much about P.G. Woodhouse either at all. So, you know, and they got a lot out of it. They loved it.
Yeah, they did. They did indeed. We ought to flag up that we've got one of our books at 99p this week.
We do. Blood Notes by Lynn LaVersha, which is the first in the Steph Grant Murder Mystery Series, is 99p and 99 cents for 1 week only. So if you haven't read it yet, absolutely brilliant book. I loved it. We both loved it on submission, didn't we? Because it's got a stinger of an opener.
Oh, yeah. I mean, arguably the best opener of any of the books.
Oh, totally.
Just jaw-dropping.
And my favourite dog in that series.
Derek the dog.
Yeah.
And, I just had the privilege of feeding back on the first draft of, or whatever draft it was, of the latest, the fourth book in the series.
Yeah, the fourth book. So that's
Blood Ribbons, which part of which takes on a veteran's trip to Arnhem, where I've just been watching A Bridge Too Far to sort of remind myself what happened in Operation Market Garden in 1944 in September. Terrific book too. And we are delighted to present you with an opportunity to get it for 99p. So that's Blood Notes, the opening book in that series. We've got lots, as ever, on our plates. You have a myriad of freelance jobs on top of the Hoback work. I'm focusing on one or two other aspects of the Hoback thing, not least going through our submissions pile.
And we're actually making good progress. I mean, you're almost halfway on the first. So we have sort of two posts, don't we? We have the, is it worthy of full manuscript? And then, obviously, a full manuscript to offer.
And look, it's wonderful to get so many good submissions because I think it's running at about a 60-40 ratio of yeses. Let's see the whole manuscript to no's. I mean, it's obviously easy to write a yes, let's see the whole manuscript email than it is for you to, when I will find a few points that I found, you know, that needed challenging, I suppose, over people we say no to, so by way of feedback. And that's much harder to write. And I know it's very disappointing for people, but we are enormously grateful when people send in. And I have read, you know, the last couple of days, I've read some stonkers, absolute stonkers. For US audiences, that's a positive thing.
I don't know. What's a stonker then?
I don't know, really. I suppose it's, you know, they're supposed to, it's a phrase we used to use at university a bit, or at least my group did.
I was going to say, I don't remember.
A stonking great read.
Oh, okay. I suppose it's a bit dated, isn't it? Stonking great read.
Yeah. It is a bit. But they've been fantastic, some of them. Yeah, you know, so... And actually, I want to read the whole thing because I was totally drawn in the first three chapters or 5,000 words.
I think out of the pile that you've read over the last few days, there's quite a lot you've read. There's about four or five people I need to email to get the full manuscript.
Oh, some just... you know, with me now, and I'm thinking, God, these are good.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
It is. It's great. I mean, we were overwhelmed, but in a really positive way. It was wonderful to get such a response to our call out.
Absolutely. I'm back in my studio recording, working on certain elements of our next big production for Hoback, which is Silence, the audio, which we did a large chunk of last year, but we haven't quite finished it yet.
Yeah.
So I've got a lot of work on that. But it's good to be just keeping that ticking along.
Yes, and we've got a few meetings this week as well.
Oh, we have,
We've got bank holiday tomorrow.
Yeah, and next week, the coronation. What do you mean? We're actually going to London the day after the coronation, which seems that after the Lord Mayor's show, but we're meeting up some of my oldest friends again. Sort of, it turns into an annual thing that we gather together.
Yes, it's nice.
And break bread together.
I like your friends.
Yeah, they're good. They're good.
I like it because I can talk about you with them and it's fun.
You can slag me off.
And I love hearing the stories. They do come out with the same stories. So about the time one of your friends drank so much he spoke French. That's a great one.
Yeah.
There's something about a car going round in circles in someone's drive or something.
We used to go round. Yeah. So the village is called Great Shelford and it's where my ex-parents-in-law live. And there's a house which has a tree in the middle of the driveway. It's if you listen to this, the people who live at the Peacocks near the church in Great Shelford, it was us. We used to drive around in a Nissan Micra around the circular drive, around their tree, and then reemerge at sort of 12 at night after being at the pub. And we did this, we call it the Mystic Tree. And we did this every time we went out because my friend Marcus lived in Great Shelford, so we'd have to take him home. And sometimes... the driver wouldn't do the circuit. He would throw us out of the car. We'd have to run round it and try and without being caught. But the security lights would come on and all this sort of thing. So,
and there's something about naked running around in some hot country or something?
Yeah. That's a different group of friends.
Oh.
But that's for another time. It is true. I did run around naked in France.
Oh, France, was it?
Yeah, singing the German national anthem.
That's it. That's the one. There's that different group of friends. Okay. I get this story.
It was a forfeit. We were playing strip poker. And that was my final forfeit, having been completely stripped naked by that point. So I'll leave you with that marvellous image. Thank you so much for joining us. Take a look at our website, of course, www.hobeck.net. Details of all our books and our audiobooks and our authors and everything that's going on. We must put some fresh material on there. We haven't done it for a bit. And... I'd just like to thank you for joining us and don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast Book Show. It's been a pleasure to speak to you. My name's been Adrian Hobart.
My name's still Rebecca Collins.
And we would like to wish you a wonderful and...
creative...
week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Hobcast from Hoback Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hoback online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.